Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films.
Hello, Craig.
Hello.
So, here we are, and it's after the holidays, and we're back to the real work, which is talking about all the Harry Potter movies. And honestly, I'll be honest, I'm a little bit behind on this one, or not behind. I guess it's already faded a little bit because I've seen two Harry Potters since the last time we spoke. But the first one we're going to talk about is the fourth film, directed by Mike Newell, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And this is a movie that I remember. I saw it. This is the first movie I watched. As a post, you know, in a post-fan state of mind. So I was after Azkaban, I was totally on board with the franchise, and I was actively excited for this one. And when I watched the film, I loved it. It blew me away. It was one of my favorite movies of that fall movie season in 2005. I was in college, so I was. It was just kind of a really good time for me to be on board with a big, you know, franchise movie, and this delivered for me. But I did look around at the time, and I saw kind of some reactions that were less than positive, and it kind of boggled my mind because I was a little bit of the mind that, hey, you know, I might like this more than Azkaban, which might make it my favorite Harry Potter movie so far. And then as the years passed and as I revisit the movie and I revisit the other movies, it's definitely slipped a considerable amount in my estimation. And I feel like I've got a clear idea of it now. I know that this is infamously, I believe, one the least, I guess the most disliked movie among hardcore fans of the book. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. All right. So, yeah, so tell me your personal experience with the movie, and then go into a little bit of, you know, from the book fan perspective, what bugs you about this one?
Yeah, so I saw this at midnight like everybody else. I loved it. I thought it was great. And I still do love this movie. It's a beautiful-looking movie. The art direction is great. I think the story is easy to follow for someone that hasn't read the book. But having said that, as a fan of the books, it guts most of it, and I think it does a decent job of keeping what story you need to know. If you're just watching the movies, having seen the previous movies and going to watch the rest of the movies, I think Goblet of Fire does an okay job of just keeping the bare-bones story there for you. So that's why my qualms are a little bit... That's why I have specific qualms with Prisoner of Azkaban, although it's one of my favorites of the whole series. Goblet of Fire has very different ones, and one of the odd differences between those two is that I think it keeps part of the story. Now, I could watch it again. I need to watch it again, and maybe I'll feel differently. But I, looking back, I think it pretty basically keeps the story going. So, but I think what a lot of the fans don't like of the book is that what the fans of the books don't like about the movie is that, and you may notice this too. And though there's a difference in the look of the first two and then the look of the third, I think Goblet of Fire completely takes a complete break in continuity of the set design, art direction, tone, and look of it, and kind of the vibe at Hogwarts itself.
Interesting. Expound on that, because I'm not sure I totally follow.
So, the school kind of looks different. It's almost like they didn't shoot in the same spots, and I know that probably is the case because once Yates got on board, it all took it was slightly different between the first three, but not enough for you to be like, hey, what? And then, but he took his own, and he kept that base and that setting, and kept it consistent for the rest of the series that he directed. But I think you look at Goblet of Fire, and even Mike Newell even said in an article I read at the time that, you know, he wanted to get a feel of Hogwarts and the students inside Hogwarts, of some kind of like boarding school, like, you know, English school vibe, like, you know, mischief at every turn, and, you know, goofing around, and, you know, and you see a lot of that, you know, the like the score is like so quirky and bouncy, and you just see kids, like, you know, messing around and, like, you know, picking on each other, and, like, while that's probably fine, it's like, you know, that's totally not Hogwarts. I think it completely breaks that, what the vibe is in that school, what that tone is. It completely comes out with a new tone, almost like half-hearted in this movie, and in the book, it's pretty, like, there's danger from the get-go. You know, the idea that someone's trying to kill Harry is a very strong point made, and it's reminded throughout the, and it's emphasized throughout the book. Another one, and I'll let you go, and another one is Michael Gambon, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like the Michael Gambon interpretation of Dumbledore comes on pretty strongly here, and I think that I see kind of, you know, what you don't like as much about him in this movie. And I feel like what I love about Gambon as Dumbledore does take off more in Azkaban, and then a little bit in Order of Phoenix, but definitely Half-Blood Prince. So I feel like this is kind of probably my least favorite of his performances. There is just something kind of odd off about him in terms of his relationship to the students.
So let me jump on that point real quick, and then we'll be done with Gambon, and we can just move on. So I think Gambon actually, in the third, he's actually decent, and in the fifth through the rest of the series, I think he does a really good job, actually. This movie, he's absolutely uncharacteristic of what Dumbledore is, especially from the books and from the other movies. For instance, when they find out, when Harry's name comes out of the Goblet of Fire, people are losing their minds. They all go to the side room. The headmasters of the other two schools, I think Snape's in there, Mad-Eye Moody's in there. And Dumbledore lunges for Harry, grabs him by his shirt, shakes him, and says, and yells at him, "Harry, did you put your name in that Goblet of Fire?" In the book, Dumbledore says nothing. He just looks at Harry and calmly and quietly asks, "Did you put your name in the Goblet of Fire?" Because Dumbledore is twice, at least twice, the wizard anybody else in that room is.
Right.
And there's three really good wizards in there. He could easily, with a flick of his pinky, just, like, win somebody, like, beat somebody in a duel or something. So the fact that Dumbledore
right.
is so close to the edge really takes away from what his character actually is, and that's what drives the fans crazy, is that this is not Dumbledore. Anyways, I think the other the whole movie, he seems like he's out of control, which even when Dumbledore it has lack of control in the book, you don't know it by his demeanor. Okay, let's go.
Danny, you get a better feeling of that in the next movie. But yeah, I think I understand the intention, which is that Dumbledore cares so much about Harry that he's letting his emotions, you know, get the best of him. But yeah, I agree that it doesn't necessarily read that way, and it does hurt the movie. In general, that's the tone you mentioned, or at least the tone of the book that you mentioned, where so much of it is about, hey, somebody's trying to kill this kid. I feel like that's there at the opening and at the close of the movie, but in the middle, I agree that it's not really there. And these the games section, while I think it's a great setup for a movie, and especially the movie in this universe, you know, you get to see kind of this tournament and and how it affects. And I think it's a good kind of school oriented yeah. plot to have, you know, sports mm-hmm. kind of. I think that each of the challenges, or really it's just the dragon challenge and the underwater challenge is, you know, they're played a little bit lighter than expected. I remember loving the dragon chase in the theater, but this time, I don't know, there's an urgency missing or something. Maybe it was, you know, they have the whole tabloid writer thing that kind of comes up and goes away, and that kind of, and they've got the romance subplots and everything, and so I think there's all that stuff that he was trying to do that was just, you know, it competed with the overall plot, and that's the tough thing in a lot of these movies, because you want to, you know, infer that this is a whole school year, so there's all sorts of different emotions and things going on, but at the same time, I remember at the time there were maybe rumors that it was going to be split into two movies, and I feel like maybe that's what they should have done, you know, have it be two movies, the first of which is more bubbly and light and about the romance, and then, you know, as we get closer to the climax, the second movie is darker. Is that something that you think would have worked better?
Yeah, I think if you did two movies, though, and I remember that, and people were hoping, you know, two movies, because to date, movie-wise, that was easily the biggest book. It's probably, it's a little less than the first three combined together. I think they could have split,
wow.
They could have split 4, 5, and 7 into two, which they did 7, obviously, and that would have worked. But I think if you had split Goblet of Fire into two movies, you had to completely rethink that tone. I don't think you can take that tone with the first and change it for the second. That's just my opinion. Maybe you could
interesting.
Totally
okay.
feel like two different movies. Because the real reason you would want to split it into two is because there's this whole other story that's not even mentioned in the book about house elves. And it sounds unimportant, but it is very important in the great scheme of things. Now, it was cut. I understand why it was cut, because if you keep it in, you can't just allude to it here and there. You got to commit, and a commitment requires another movie. But that from the Quidditch World Cup, that's where, you know, the Death Eaters return, and there's this whole blame game put on one of the ministers' house elves, and that this opens the idea of the house elves in the magical world. You see just what the house elves do at Hogwarts. There's a whole slew of house elves at Hogwarts that clean everything and cook everything. You learn how the food shows up in the Great Hall. It, like, magically shows up. Well, you learn how that happens to the house elves. Harry, Ron, and Hermione go see the house elves. Like, they get the house elves to, like, hook them up with food and stuff. And Dobby has a great part here because he's helping to try and solve, you know, house elf that was wrongfully accused, who actually is now living out. It's this whole thing about house elves, and it.
Wow.
And while I don't hold it against the movie that they cut it out, because you can clearly tell that story without it. But that's why people were thinking they're going to have to do two movies if they're going to even mention house elves. So there you go.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I do want to go quickly into what I really loved. I think one of the things early in the movie that got me on my first viewing and still remains great, and it's something very simple. It's a relatively quick shot. It's whenever Harry and Ron's family are going to the World Cup, and they come across the portkey. Is that the boot that transports them to the World Cup? A portkey.
Yeah.
I know the terms. I'm a grown up.
The Mangiel boot.
When they're approaching that boot, it's a low angle steadicam shot in silhouette against like the sunrise, and then it kind of, as it comes closer to the boot, kind of rotates around it.
And it's this moment where it's, you know, they didn't use CGI. They didn't use any crazy camera tricks. It was just, you know, the right lens choice, the right angle, the right movement, and the right light. And it feels entirely magical. And it was just this really beautiful little transcendent moment that kind of made the movie for me the first time I watched it, where I was like, wow, we're again in the hands of a filmmaker that knows how to use cinema to make magic happen without, you know, without all this other stuff. Now, I do think that the rest of the movie, Newell does rely on CGI an awful lot, and I feel like that's a lot of the worst parts of the movie. That underwater sequence, I think, is one of my least favorite sequences in the series. And then you mentioned the color tones and everything, and overall there's this digital color grade of everything that makes everything look green. That's really gross, and I'm glad that Yates got away from that. But then again, the thing I really like is the whole introduction of Voldemort, I think, is masterfully done. I think they knew that, okay, this is a huge moment in the series. If you take nothing else from this movie, this is the moment that you've got to walk away from. And I think that moment, again, when I was watching it this time, through much of the rewatch, I was thinking, wow, why did I love this so much? Like, this, nothing here is terrible, really. It's just not that good, or it's just not that engaging.
Yeah.
And then that part happened, and I was like, oh, right. I think every time I watched it in the theater, I went out on such a high, because the whole death of Cedric Diggory and the reveal of Voldemort and the aftermath and the chaos and the trauma of everything, I think that is so well delivered and so tragic, and the movie ends on such a bittersweet note that every single time I was like, wow, this is good drama. This is good tension that they're managing to wring out of this situation.
Yeah, you know, the end where Hermione goes, or they're watching the other schools leave, and Hermione's like, can we just have a normal year at Hogwarts? And they kind of look at each other and kind of like, yeah, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, no. Like, another thing about that is that, they are legitimately alarmed at the idea that Voldemort is back, and no one believes him. So you leave this movie with Harry, Ron and Hermione, obviously, Dumbledore, Ron's parents, and Snape, convinced wholly that Lord Voldemort is back. And you've got the Minister of Magic and some other people that are like, no, he's not back. There's no way. And in fact, that sets the tone for the whole fifth book, where the whole movie,
right,
they are trying to convince people that do not want to believe, that are putting their head in the sand. And that perfectly sets up that ready for this, for that fifth book spike and the tone for that, and it's really great. And this movie just ends like, man, we can't just have a normal school year, can we? No, oh, I guess we'll go home now. No, they're like, oh crap, he's coming
after
everybody, and we're the one that knows. Another thing is that the whole Voldemort rebirth thing, you know, that's how he just killed Cedric. Peter Pettigrew just sort of kills Cedric without even talking, just kills him. That type of coldness is and closeness to death is lingering in the air throughout the whole book. You know, Voldemort was inhabiting the body of like a baby, you know? Like,
yeah.
That strongly suggests some seriously dark stuff. Some nauseatingly dark stuff. The beginning and that is completely lost in the movie. I mean, it's almost like in a trolling way. You know, like, we're just going to completely change this.
He's actually like possessing a child.
It's
and then they transfer the body or something, or they grow the body.
Yeah, that's a the book doesn't say that, but excuse me, J.K. Rowling has said in interviews, you know, she doesn't even want to talk about how there are two things she doesn't want to talk about: how Horcruxes are made, and how Voldemort was able to get a body back. And she's going to write about it someday. but she didn't want to go into detail. I think that adds to the mystery if you don't go into detail in the books about stuff like that.
Yeah. Well,
but,
I mean,
but that's
I think that that's okay because
fetus. Yeah. No, totally.
Well, I think that's okay in the movies because they come up with this other visual that they bring back in the last movie of that, just this little withering, you know, baby fetus,
right.
Frankenstein,
well,
thing that is so strong. So I feel like that is it. It does suck some of that mystery out if they just out and out how that happens.
I totally agree. But I was just saying that's how people realize it was she describes it as sort of a small cheetah looking thing, and you're right. It is exactly the thing that shows up in King's Cross at the end of Deathly Hallows when Voldemort loses that piece of his soul. But, you know, one thing that plot-wise that I do kind of resent the movie for is that you understand Barty Crouch's son, correct? The guy that disguised himself as Mad-Eye Moody for the entire year.
Right.
He is the son of a very respected, high-up ministry official, right?
Right.
Did you get that? Okay. So he is – and I love the opening scene of Goblet of Fire. It nails it pretty much really well in a fraction of the time that the book does. It takes out conversation. Lord Voldemort is talking from this little infant fetus thing, and it's a frightening thing, and you don't get all that much, but it does a good job of capturing that scene in a fraction of the time it would take to read it. But Barty Crouch is not in that scene. Voldemort, via the baby, says we have to convince our old comrade or something like that to help us out. That's all he says. So what you're thinking the whole book is, oh crap,
that's Mad-Eye Moody,
or the Durmstrang guy, or
right,
it's this guy, or this guy that's not even in the movie. His name's Hugo Bagman, and he's a guy that's involved in the Quidditch, and he's there at every champion at every event, Triwizard Tournament event, and he's just sitting, and Barty Crouch. So there are at least four individuals that you're thinking the whole time you're looking back to this opening scene, you're like, who is Voldemort saying we're bringing back an old loyal friend to restore things? Barty Crouch, Snape, the Durmstrang headmaster, or is it, you know, Hugo Bagman? And because they established in the beginning, Barty Crouch's son is in Azkaban, because he was a Death Eater with Bellatrix Lestrange and all them. And you don't realize till the very end that it's Barty Crouch's son. But there are hints throughout the book that the Barty Crouch character knew something was up with Mad-Eye Moody. Very subtle. And that whole thing is lost. I think that would have been really cool. I understand why they're trying to restructure.
Yeah, that's a lot.
They're trying to loop him back into the beginning so they don't have to pull the rug out from under us in a movie. So I
right. So
get
we've
that,
seen.
But,
so we've actually seen the guy before. Well, I understand what they did, but that said, the whole Mad-Eye Moody thing does seem like such a tell the entire time with his tongue flicking out. And I remember after I saw it the second time, I took I went with my friend Lee, and he was like, so it's basically, we walked out, and he's a Harry Potter skeptic, and we walked out and he's like, so it's basically like a Scooby-Doo mystery. And I was like, well, yeah, that's a really reductive way to do it. Of course, he's a huge Scooby-Doo mark. But that is kind of how it feels, especially compared to the other movies, you know, where she uses red herrings a lot for her antagonists, which is good, but I feel like this is one of the weaker ones. I mentioned earlier that for me there's really nothing terrible in the movie, but that's not true. There is one terrible thing in the movie, and it's the worst thing in any Harry Potter movie. And it's the scene where he is in the bath area, and he has to find the egg thing for the underwater sequence, and Moaning Myrtle is there. And I think I mentioned already that she's my least favorite character and one of the most obnoxious movie characters of all time for me. And it gets no better here, because you combine it with just the general terribleness of the character with this totally nonsensical scene where he's using bubbles to cover up his private parts, but she's underwater, and there's no bubbles there, but she's, like, trying to see his junk. And it's just, I understand, like, Newell was going for, like, you know, adolescent sexual tension there, but it's just so dumb and lame and in a way upsetting, because this is a ghost. Like, what are the needs of a ghost here? I mean, it just opens up all this stuff. Is that in the book? And if so, can it not be? Can she retcon that?
That goes back to this tone of kids being silly. And even during serious moments, a scene will end and they'll be laughing at a joke or something. Somebody will do something lighthearted, and it's just like, that's how you change the tone of the students' lives here, and I think it's kind of not a good decision. But it is in the book, because there's this whole idea, you know, him and Cedric trying to help each other reluctantly. They both...
No, I guess I like the setup of the scene. I like the function of the scene. I just don't like her and the gag.
No, in the book, she simply... In the book, she is there. She helped him. In the book, she says, "Hey, you should try to put that thing underwater when you open it." That's basically
okay. But she's not attracted to him or trying to sneak a peek at his elder wand.
You could at his adolescent. I'm sorry.
his
can we
younger
work on
wand.
This? No. You could probably suggest, like, Myrtle probably has a little crush on Harry, but it's nothing like her splashing around being real goofy. And I mean, she's a goofy character in the book for sure, but she lives in like the plumbing of the school, so she could crop up at any time. But she, which is interesting because she was killed by the basilisk, who kind of was plumbing around in there. Anyways, she doesn't take a look at his junk.
Okay. All right, so that's totally Mike Newell, and now I know.
As she peeked around a bubble.
Yeah. Well, there's that, and I see what you're saying now. And there's that moment where Harry sees the girl he has a crush on, and he, like, smiles, and, like, water dribbles out of his mouth. And it's like, that's just a really cool, weird, contrived, I don't know, something about that. I can see what you're saying. It's this imposition of adolescent anxiety, I guess, played for laughs. That it's not that it doesn't belong. It's because I do like the scene at the dance and the whole thing between Hermione and Ron and who asked them, and you know, Ron, because I remember being that guy. You know, the guy that was grumpy at the dance and ruined the time for the girl that he brought or didn't bring or whatever. I remember that kind of stuff. That's true life. So I like that stuff, but I feel like a lot of the rest of it, I agree with you, just doesn't fit that well.
Yeah, you know, if they're going to focus on the students in any way, or the life, or the what's going on with the students at Hogwarts, they need to take a look at the book and just say, at every turn, Harry was ridiculed because people thought he put his name in there, because the attention always has to be on him. And, of course, it's never because he puts it on himself. He does not want the attention. Truly, genuinely, he does not want the attention. And so people are automatically thinking, you put your name in the goblet, you got to have attention, or you got to be the center of the attention, or you got to be the star of the show. And so he's at every turn, he is being bullied and ridiculed by other students. And you get that a little bit, but too much of it is focused on, you know, what Ron's twin brothers are trying to do, in, you know, trying to force their own name in there and all kinds of stuff. So it's just, it's unfortunate that they focus on that and not the actual tone of what it should be.
All right. Well, last point, and I'll only bring this up because, like I said, I've watched the fifth movie, and we're actually a little bit into the sixth movie, and I'm kind of wondering if this was. I feel like a ball was dropped here, and I'm just wondering if this was Newell or if it was just something I didn't know. I feel like this is the movie, and maybe it's in here, and I just missed it every single time I've watched it, or I'm not remembering it or something. I feel like this is the movie where they should have really started setting up something between Harry and Ginny Weasley. And that's not to say that she should have been, the girl that he wanted to go to the dance with the whole movie, or the girl that he competed with Cedric over, but just something to let us know that, you know, she's transitioning from the girl he saved once to, you know, his future wife and the mother of his children. I feel like, is that something that Newell knew and just didn't really think was important, or that Rowling knew? And where is that when is that set up in the book? And because it feels like it's a little bit in the fifth movie, but then it's like a huge element of the sixth movie. And it feels like it kind of comes out of nowhere. Even though it's a really good element in Half-Blood Prince, but I do feel like it could have been set up earlier on.
Yeah, I think that really comes into fruition, I'm trying to think back, in the sixth book, because Harry notices her actually dating someone. He's like, wait, what? I've always pictured her as your little sister. And in the fifth book, he actually is dating Cho Chang for a little bit, but also he's, you know, trying to figure out how he's not going to get murdered, because that is
right.
a bigger possibility in the fifth movie than in the other one. And I believe it's after the Valentine's Day part, there's no other mention of any kind of crush, I don't think. And the sixth book is when he's like, oh, wait, she's actually dating somebody. Wait, let me look at her in a different way now. And that's when that really comes out. So Cho,
okay.
I mean, I'm
so
sorry.
That's basically how it plays out in the movies.
Yeah, Harry discovers he likes girls in this movie, in this book.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I guess that makes sense if, you know, she's, you know, that is that whole thing of when you're in different grades, you know, it's not even a possibility. You know, there's no noticing other people in other grades when you're that age. So, okay, I guess that makes sense. I won't hold that against these movies. Well, in general, I think, again, this movie has enough high points for me to like it. I do feel like visually it's one of the weaker movies in the series. So for me, it's kind of at the bottom of my list. Is this your least favorite?
Yeah, it is. But I still enjoy it. It's endearing to me.
Yeah,
I think back fondly on it. Yeah, but it's my least favorite for sure.
Interesting. All right. Well, that was us discussing Harry Potter and the Dumpster of Fire. And hopefully we'll get to the next movie pretty quickly, since I just recently watched it and normal life is coming back to stay. So, Craig, thanks for talking to me about this, and look forward to talking about Order of the Phoenix soon.
All right. Let's do it.
For Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.